Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you very much. So last week we spoke about we started speaking about hearing aids and speakers in halacha, and we primarily focused on analyzing the different views within the position that thinks that when you speak into a microphone, and as we mentioned that any type of microphone, so it's microphone in the classical sense, a microphone in a speaker or a classical hearing aid, which is basically just a microphone and a speaker in the ear. Same thing with telephones, which is basically just a microphone on one end and a speaker on the other end. Any one of those, any one of those would. So we discussed the position that thinks that that would be considered halachic talking. So in that case, if I am reading Megillah, so to, if I'm reading Megillah, for example, and you hear me reading the Megillah over the microphone, in whichever one of those instances, then you would fulfill your obligation of hearing Megillah. So as we mentioned, there's a couple of different views that primarily depended on how you define kol havara, which by shofar, we said there's a requirement that it not be a, there's some sort of requirement that it does not have kol havara. It was unclear exactly what kol havara meant. It either means some sort of time delay, or it meant that the sound isn't as good as the original quality, as the original sound, the quality isn't as good. Something along those lines. For whatever reason, shofar might not necessarily work over a microphone. But as we mentioned, that is there's that's a debate. So according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, according to the Chazon Ish, a microphone can be used even for shofar, and according to the Tzitz Eliezer, and his and the people that think like him, you can only use a microphone for other mitzvahs. But for a shofar, there's special requirements, the kol havara, and you can't use a microphone for that. That was all what we discussed last week, and we spent a lot of time thinking about the different positions and the variations within those positions. This week, I want to introduce one the opposing view, which is much easier because it's really only there's really one pioneer that thinks like this, so it's much quicker. And then after we discuss the two different views, then discuss the halachic ramifications of those views. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, he is obviously a very was a very is still a very important posig. He thinks about kol havara physically. In other words, that the problem with shofar, and again, kol havara is when you blow a shofar into a pit and then you hear the echo. So you hear both the sound of the original shofar plus you hear the echo. He thinks the problem there is that the sound that the person hears isn't just the sound of the actual shofar. It's also the sound of the, it's also the sound waves that are bouncing off in that pit and being transmitted to the ear. So those extra sound waves that are being produced would be an issue. And therefore, he thinks that that's the rule across the board. And therefore, a microphone, which what happens with a microphone, it picks up, it receives the sound waves, it then converts it to an electrical signal, and then sends, converts it back into a sound wave when it amplifies that sound through the speaker. That would not be considered halachic talking because that's not the person actually talking. That is the speaker talking. It's fundamentally different. So therefore, if I try to let's say read Megillas Esther over the microphone, or I blow shofar, definitely if I blow shofar over a microphone, I would not be able to fulfill any obligation. Right? Orbach acknowledges the fact that that would mean that if someone who's hard of hearing can't hear without a hearing aid, they would not be able to be fulfill their obligation by use of a hearing aid. A hearing aid would mean that the hearing aid is the one doing the talking, not the person, because the sound wave got converted, and therefore he won't be he cannot they that person would not be able to fulfill their obligation. Now he's really defining halachic sound as it's a little bit difficult to know exactly how he's defining it. This could be one of two focuses. One could be that his focus is, I think it's more accurate, but one is that his focus is that halachic sound is sound waves that are produced by the vocal cords. the sound waves that are produced by anything other than the vocal cords is not considered halachic sound. Whereas the other way of thinking about it potentially is that what he cares about is that there is only the sound waves that are produced by the person. Those are the sound waves that are important. If the sound waves then get converted to anything else along the way, then that's not considered halachic talking. Whatever converted those sound waves, that's what's talking, since obviously a speaker is not obligated in mitzvahs, so a speaker cannot allow someone else to fulfill their obligation. Now, what I think that means then is, if we want to carefully define the two opposing views, I think we end with something like this. On the one side, we have any sound that results from human intervention is considered halachic talking. Now, I want to be very careful, because if I'm not, then we can end up in a some sort of absurd position, which is, if I obviously will have to limit this to my vocal cords, to any sound that I produce from my mouth. If I don't limit it, then if I somehow, let's say, for example, figure out how to blow a shofar through my nose, I would consider that blowing shofar. I don't know. I assume most people wouldn't consider that blowing shofar specifically through the mouth. You can't, just because you made a noise with your body, that doesn't necessarily count. That's one. And on the other hand, I also have to limit it because I have to, as you mentioned last week, I have to introduce the concept of a time delay. In other words, when I make a sound and it's heard over a speaker, there can't be any delay between the time that I'm talking and you hearing that sound. If I do allow a delay, then I can very easily, one year, just record myself leaning Megillas Esther, and then every year I'll just play it back again, and I will just fulfill my obligation that way. So there's obviously has to be some sort of requirement that there is, that the sound is heard immediately, and that there is no delay in between me speaking and anyone else hearing that sound. That then means that the definition of sound, according to this view, would be any sound produced due to natural, any sound produced through the vocal cords and without a time delay would be considered halachic sound. That's one definition. That's one way of thinking about what is considered halachic talking. And the other way of thinking about halachic talking is that halachic sound has to imitate biological sound. And that is air that's pushed through the vocal cords and then resonates through the upper airway tract. That's producing halachic sound. A speaker that produces halachic sound is attributed to the speaker, not to the person that that made the sound. And therefore, that's not considered halachic talking. Now, obviously, since I spent so much time carefully formulating these definitions, I'm going to challenge my own definitions, and I'm going to question them. And by doing that, I'm going to first address the first potential practical ramification of these positions by thinking of the least likely scenario, and that is if we consider Stephen Hawking. Now, Stephen Hawking, the way he speaks, he had something called a speech-generating device. Which that means that he had some speaker system attached to a computer. The computer was able to track his movements, and that's how it knew what he wanted to say. So there were a few words displayed on the screen. Originally, he apparently was able to use his finger to do this, and he was able to select words on the screen, and then the speaker would speak for him. And then eventually he had paralysis in his finger as well. So apparently only one of his cheeks was still able to move. So just by twitching his cheek, he was able to generate sound. So this the speech generating device would make sound with his input, however minimal it was. This is not just Stephen Hawking. These devices are available for people that suffer from paralysis, either ALS or CP. But they can basically, they track either your eye gaze, they track your head movements, or you can have a joystick with a finger. But basically, you're able to speak using these devices. The devices produce a sound for you. So now, obviously, the question is, if these devices apparently work very slowly, so I wouldn't recommend hearing someone Lane Megillah through these devices. It might take a very long time. But in theory, if, let's say, it was possible to Lane Megillah with these devices, if you know, assuming the technology catches up relatively quickly, then the question would be, if someone learns Megillah or if someone daments for the Amud using one of these devices, would that be considered halachically talking or not? So I'd like to point out that according to the first view that we mentioned before, that is that halachic talking is that we don't necessarily need natural halachic talking. What we need, what's more important, is that the sound is initiated by the person. It's easier to potentially consider their position as assuming that this would be allowed. This would be considered halachic talking. However, I'd like to point out that it's not really clear at all, obviously, because it could very well be that their position is limited to halachic sound that is produced by a normal way of talking. If I speak, then it doesn't matter what happens next, but there is still the requirement that I speak. However, as we mentioned last week, there is at least one position, Rabbi Orenstein's position, where he describes sound. He doesn't seem to care so much about where the sound is produced. He just cares about the sound that's being produced. He calls it some sort of vibrating air. So maybe according to him, it's irrelevant how that vibrating air occurs. What's more important is that it does occur from because of a person's intervention. So if I am able to get a device to produce the required sounds, in other words, to produce the sounds of Megillas Esther, then maybe that would be good enough to be considered halachic talking. And it's irrelevant that it wasn't done through the vocal cords. That's one possibility. Now, I want to point out that even in the opposite position, even according to Rav Orbach's position, who thinks that speaking has to be more natural, even according to him, it might be possible that he would agree that this would be considered halachically talking. Again, I just want to emphasize, this is a lot of speculation on my part. I don't have any halachic sources at all. I'm not aware of any recent articles or anything of the sort that discusses this. So I'm just trying to utilize the principles that we have from these positions to try to apply to this case. But maybe Rav Orbach would think, so it would depend maybe on how I think about Rav Orbach's position. So on the one hand, one of my options of how to think about it is that he's very much cares that halachically talking, halacha considers talking anything that's produced by the vocal cords. If I'm not producing noise through my vocal cords, that is not halachically talking at all. In which case, it's obvious that the speech generating device is not considered talking. I would not be able to, a CP patient would not be able to lay in Megillah for me using one of these devices. But if what's important, according to Shlomo Zalman, is that the sound waves is what's important. So what's important is that the sound waves that I produce are the sound waves that the person hears, and that there is no intermediary where they're converted into something else, then it could very well be that Rav Orbach would think that using one of these speakers, speaker generating devices, would be considered halachically talking. Because sound waves are not being converted. I am producing the initial sound wave. I happen to be doing it in a weird way, moving my eyes, and that's causing the computer to make the sound wave, but the sound waves aren't being converted to anything else. And in which case, it might very well be that that would be considered halachically talking. So as far as speech generating devices, I think we really could think about it in one of two. We could think about it within both positions. Within both positions, there's a possibility that either both of them would agree that this is considered halachically talking. There are a couple of other areas in halacha that are more commonly discussed and more and a little bit more more relevant for most people. So I'd like to go through a couple of them right now and discuss some of those sources as well. Rabbi Stern, who lived from 1914 to 1997, he was a dayan in Hungary. He survived Bergen-Belsen. He was in a concentration camp and then eventually made his way to New York. He has a series of sfarim called Bera Moshe, and he has a section dealing with discussing problems caused by electricity, modern-day electricity problems. Within that section, he has he discusses microphones and recorded devices. So he assumes, like Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in principle, he agrees with him. He thinks that he's 100% right. And he thinks that anyone that disagrees with Rav Shlomo Zalman, this is not just uniquely to him. Rav Avad Yosef also says this. A couple of other people also say this, that he assumes anyone that disagreed with Shlomo Zalman Orbach just didn't understand how microphones work. This is a very common assumption in this sugya, that a lot of people just think that whoever thought that a microphone is considered halachic talking, thought that there was a mixture of sounds, and thought that a human voice is actually being transmitted over the speaker. So they completely dismiss the opposing view. They really just think like Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. But what's interesting about Rabbi Stern's position is that he assumes like Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach in principle, but in practicality, he ends up assuming like the other position. I'll explain what I mean. So first of all, he seems to think that if you're not allowed to record play recordings of anything that has Hashem's name in it in a bathroom or in somewhere that has a dirty place. Now, that one's not such a big chiddush. He just happens to think the problem is not, again, he doesn't think it's halachic sound. So he can't argue that the problem with playing Hashem's name over, let's say, in a bathroom is like saying Hashem's name in a bathroom. He can't think that's the problem. What he does think the issue is that if you hear, let's say, a Dvar Torah while you're in the bathroom, you're going to be thinking about the Torah in the bathroom, and that's not allowed. Okay, that's not such a big deal. That's, you know, fine. That you end up in the same place. There's a problem. There's a prohibition of listening, of thinking about the Torah in the bathroom, so you shouldn't be listening to it. That's okay, fine. What's much more interesting is that he argues that you're not allowed to listen to a woman singing over a recording. Now, I'll just backtrack for a second, right? There's an Isser of Kol Isha. What exactly that Isser is not entirely clear. Is it just when it's a one-on-one? We're not allowed to listen to a woman sing. Is it the same thing when they're singing a Shabbos song? Is it the same thing when it's a choir or when you're listening to a Broadway play? It's not exactly clear. But just for purposes of the just to focus on the recording issue, Rav Orbach, so according to Rav Shlomo Zalman, a human sound, a human voice, a halachic sound, I mean to say, over a recording is not considered halachically talking. In which case, a woman singing over a microphone, irrespective of what you think about any one of these other issues, should be completely irrelevant. There's a isser, there's a prohibition to listen to a woman sing. You're not listening to a woman sing. You're listening to a speaker sing. There is no prohibition of listening to a speaker sing. There's nothing wrong with that. Rabbi Stern still argues that there's an issue with it, though. And he claims that his problem is, and this is in a classic sort of more of a Hasidish fashion, he argues that the problem is, yes, it's not a woman's voice, but it's not within the spirit of halacha. There's an issue. There's an issue. The isser of Kol Isha is that you might think about her in an appropriate way. And so if you hear listen to over a recording, it's irrelevant whether or not it's a speaker talking or it's a woman talking. You might have inappropriate thoughts regardless. And so therefore, it wouldn't be allowed, which is very interesting because this ends up disagreeing with, I think, both sides. So if you think according to Orbach, there shouldn't be a problem at all because it's not a woman's voice. So he has to take it a step further and he has to come up with his own prohibition. But even according to the opposing view, even according to the voice that thinks it is a human sound, there's a difference if the sound is recorded or if the sound is live. We said by definition, according, and this is explicit in Rav Karelitz's position, the Chazon Ish's position, that live music, that speaking through a microphone can only be attributed to the human voice if it's live. If it's not live, if there's a time delay, in other words, if there's a recording, then it's not considered halachically talking. In which case, according to the Chazon Ish, according to the opposite view, anytime the sound is live, the woman is singing live, that would potentially be considered an issue. But if it's recording, then there shouldn't be a problem at all. So, but Rabbi Stern says there's an issue even when the sound is recorded. So he really ends up disagreeing with both views. And because of his idea that there's a problem here, I guess if you want to call it the spirit of halacha, that you know you're still hearing the woman's voice, irrespective of how exactly you're hearing it, or it's a speaker, it's not a woman, is it still it's going to be an issue? And across the board, he won't allow it. That is for Kol Isha. Now, thanks to COVID, tragic pandemic in general, but there were a lot of interesting halachic questions that came up, which did make for some interesting discussions and ended up with a lot of response, which gives us what to talk about. So one of the very first controversies that came up was, as you remember, right before Pesach. There was a concern. We didn't want grandparents to get together with their families. So there was this Beis Din that I'm not sure anyone really knew who they were before, but they became very popular as soon as they published this response. This responsa, they argued that the grandparents can join their kids Seder, their grandkids Seder, they could still be with the family over Zoom. They'll stay home and everybody else will be in their house and they'll log in over Zoom and they'll be able to join the Seder. Now, there's a whole bunch of issues with this, which has nothing to do with microphones, so we're going to avoid all of them. And I'm going to specifically focus on the one issue which is relevant to us, which is if the kids are now saying Kiddush and the grandparents hear it, is that considered, can they be, fulfill their obligation of Kiddush over Zoom? Now, there are two other concerns of how this comes up on Shabbos and whether or not you're allowed to use a speaker on Shabbos. So, well, first, as far as the Kiddush, obviously that will depend on these two positions. According to the view that thinks speaking over a speaker is halachically talking, then there shouldn't be any time delay. Maybe if you had a bad Wi-Fi connection, we can discuss if that's a time delay. It gets a little bit too complicated. I'm not trying to really think about that. But I assume this, for all practical purposes, is not really considered a time delay. So according to the Chazon Ish, according to Moshe Feinstein, possibly, according to that view, they would be able to fulfill their obligation of Kiddush. And according to the opposing view, they would have a problem. They wouldn't be able to fulfill their obligation of Kiddush and have to do Kiddush themselves. In addition, there are two other problems with using speakers on Shabbos. This became a big issue originally when this was discussed, was a lot with keeping your TV on over Shabbos, right? People want to watch TV on Shabbos, so I know I'm not allowed to turn my TV on Shabbos. So I'll leave it on before Shabbos and I'll have it on all Shabbos. What's wrong with that? So there are two possible issues with that. One is called Shemi Yitaken, and the other one is Av Shemilsa. So I want to discuss both of those for a little bit. The Isser of Shemi Yitaken is that I can't use a musical instrument on Shabbos. In principle, there's nothing wrong with playing a piano on Shabbos. There's no malacha being done, right? Assuming it's a real piano, not the electric ones, right? There's no Isser. But there is a Gzera Derabanan that we're afraid of Shema Yitakin. And we're afraid that maybe you'll fix it. Maybe the piano will break. It will need some tuning. And then if I go ahead and fix the piano, I'll be over. I'll end up doing the biblical prohibition of Bona. So that really then depends whether or not is a microphone considered considered a musical instrument. Is it not considered a musical instrument? Because this is specifically a Gzera for musical instruments originally. However, the Rama, when he quotes this halacha in Shulchan Aruch, he extends this Isser to any device whose purpose is to make noise, such that he thinks he includes in that Isser, in that Gzera, using a door knocker on Shabbos, right? When you have that little metal thing on the doors, right, in order to make more noise, he says you're not allowed to use that on Shabbos. That's part of the Gzera of Shemi Yitaken. However, the Bir Halacha says he limits that. The problem with what the Rama is doing is that in general, when you have a Gzera, it's limited to what the Gzera was about, right? In general, in Halacha, when we have Gzeras, we never extend it further than the actual Gzera. Gzeras are incredibly limited. That's how Gzeras work. For example, if I could guess that if Chazal were around nowadays, they would tell me there's a Gzera called electricity. They're not around nowadays, so there is no Gzera called electricity, so there's nothing they can do about it. Now, we could discuss which parts of electricity are then I'm allowed to use on Shabbos, which parts I'm not allowed to use on Shabbos. For example, if I plug something in, maybe I'm doing Bona, maybe I'm doing some sort of Eish problem. There might be some issue there. But let's say if I use a Shabbos clock, then there might not be any problem at all. But if Chazal were around, they gave me this Gzera of electricity, right? Then that Shabbos clock might also be a problem. But since Chazal aren't around, it's too bad, tough luck. And there is no such Gzera. We don't extend Gzeras unless Chazal explicitly told us what it is that they disallowed. Therefore, what the Rama's doing is a little bit troubling because he's taking this Gzera of fixing a musical instrument and he's extending it to things which aren't musical instruments, which is a little interesting. But the Rama says it. So it's a little bit different when the Rama does it and when somebody else does it. So the Rama is relatively important in Judaism. So when he extends a Gzera, we tend to take it seriously. However, the Bir Halacha limits his Gzera because, again, for this reason. And he says that it's only when there is a tzorach gadol, for whatever reason, you have a great need that you need to use it, that you need to, let's say, use the door knocker. Nobody's hearing you. It's freezing outside. You're going to be locked out of the house all night unless you use the door knocker. Then he says it would be allowed in that situation to use it. The gzera won't apply in that case. Now, it's unclear if Zoom is considered a great need or not. I'm not really sure. Again, their argument was that they were worried about some psychological or psychiatric illnesses that people had if they were lonely. That's obviously pikuach nefesh, a potential pikuach nefesh. It's a totally different question. It has nothing really to do. It's completely, this whole discussion is completely irrelevant. If you're talking about pikuach nefesh, everything else is out the window. You know, do what you need to do. But leaving that aside, for, let's say, hearing aids, then it would definitely be allowed to use a hearing aid on Shabbos because that's obviously, even according to the Bir Halacha, it's a tzarech gadol, it's a great need, you definitely need to be able to use it. Now, I also would like to point out that Shema Yitaken should, in theory, only be an issue according to the people that think that speaking into a microphone is not a human voice. Because if speaking into a microphone is a human voice, then it's definitely not a musical instrument, and it shouldn't really be considered a device that's making sound, right? It's a human sound. It's considered human voice. What difference does it make? Which I think is a great argument, except that Rav Feinstein, which we're assuming based on the previous year, thinks that speaking into a microphone is considered a human voice. He specifically, in a different responsa, says that part of the problem of using a microphone on Shabbos is Shema Yitake, which doesn't really fit in very nicely with our equation. Now, there's two things I would say in my defense. One is that Rabbi Feinstein, in that response, says he doesn't really understand how microphones work. So it could very well be he wasn't really clear on his position at that point. So I'm still comfortable making the argument that Rabbi Feinstein does think that speaking to a microphone is considered halachically talking. That's one. And two, it could just very well be that Rabbi Feinstein has, it's the same thing as Issur Ramah. This Ramah extended Shema Yitaken from musical instruments to anything that make noise. It could be these are two separate questions. There's one problem of using a microphone because it's amplifying sound. The amplifying sound doesn't mean that it's not human voice. It just means that you're using a device to amplify the human voice, but it's still human voice. And amplifying the human voice is considered a problem, Shema Yitaken, according to Moshe Feinstein. That is potentially my two defenses. The way I think that even according to Moshe, you still can argue that there would be a problem with Shema Yitaken with using a microphone. That's one problem with using a speaker on Shabbos. The other problem with using a speaker on Shabbos is a concept called Avsha Milsa. Now, there is an issue with Avsha Milsa. I'm sorry about that. This is another rabbinic decree that you're not allowed to use devices on Shabbos that violate one of the 39 melachas if they make noise, if they were left on before Shabbos. Now, the classical example in the Gemara is I'm not allowed to keep my windmill running on Shabbos, even though I didn't do anything on Shabbos, it runs on its own. I'm not allowed to let it to keep grinding wheat on Shabbos because it makes noise. Now, there are two possible reasons why that's a problem. One reason why this potentially could be a problem is because if we don't want one of the 39 melachas to occur on Shabbos. It's not, the day of Shabbos is about rest. It's a day that we make sure the 39 melachas do not happen. So we don't want it to happen, even if it's something that's occurring without my input. We don't want it to occur. That's one issue. The other one is we're afraid that the other possibility of why Avsha Milsa is a problem is because we're afraid people will think that you turned it on Shabbos. You put your grain inside the windmill on Shabbos, and that's why there's a problem. This, by the way, is the reason why you're not, for example, supposed to leave your washing machine on from before Shabbos, right? So if I have dirty clothes, right, you throw it into the washing machine right before Shabbos, then I have it running on Shabbos. That's a problem of Avsha Milsa. Just to point out, there's again, if there's a great need, then again, you might have leniencies for it. But in general, that's why you're not allowed to leave things like that on Shabbos. Now, there's not really, it might not be relevant to microphones and hearing aids. Rav Rosen, who actually only died a few years ago. He was the head of Tzomet, which is that Israeli company, and I think they're in Gush. That produces all those halachically. Whenever you go in Israel and you buy any one of those things that says it's mutter to use on Shabbos, they have a hechsher on it. It's usually from Tzomet. They're the ones that produce all those devices, things that you're allowed to use. They're the ones that have the that wheelchair that they say you can use at Shabbos for whatever reason, or the their hot plate that they use. That's Tzomet. So anyway, he has they have very long essay. They have a lot of material defending, describing their devices and why they're allowed to be used. Anyway, he has a whole essay which points out that most microphones is apparently one exception, but in general, microphones do not qualify as one of the 39 melachas, right? Using a microphone on Shabbos is not a problem because of one of the 39 melachas, because Again, with electricity, the problem with electricity is if I am creating current or something along those lines. By microphones, you're not really creating current. The current is already there. It's already plugged in. It's already turned on. As long as I'm speaking into the microphone, nothing really changes. And so there is no melacha occurring. Afshe milsa is only a problem if one of the 39 melachas are occurring, and that's the sound that I'm hearing, right? The sound that I'm hearing is something baking. The sound that I'm hearing is something being washed. The sound that I'm hearing is something grinding. That's afshe milsa. There is no problem with afshe milsa if, you know, just because something makes noise, if it's not a melacha. If your kid's running around, that makes a lot of noise. It's not a melacha. There's nothing wrong with running around. So same thing with microphones. There's nothing wrong with speaking into a microphone in theory. There is, so that's why afshe milsa wouldn't either be an issue with microphones and chats. Now there is potentially one other reason why microphones shouldn't necessarily be a problem, but we're going to talk about that more in a later shiur. And that is, by a microphone, it's unclear what you're really doing wrong. You're just speaking, right? Speaking naturally, maybe not so much on a microphone, definitely with a hearing aid, right? If I'm just speaking, you just happen to hear it. I'm speaking as part of a biological function. As a human being, I speak. That's not necessarily a melacha. That's not necessarily something that's wrong. It'll be hard to really qualify what the iser is. I will discuss that issue later with some other medical devices. How exactly to think about that issue. So that's Shabbos. Now the other thing to really think about is using a microphone in shul or using a microphone by weddings and things of that nature. So in general, in order to have a minyan, a minyan means 10 men are together in the same room and they're there to daven together, they're there to pray together. That's what qualifies as a minyan in halacha. So therefore, right, there were definitely some reform shuls that during COVID, they tried to have virtual minyanim. So everyone was in their own house, they all logged into Zoom, and they would have a minyan together because they were all in the same Zoom room. Halachically, at least for Orthodox Judaism, that's not considered a minyan. For us, you have to have 10 people within one room in order to have a minyan. So the virtual minyanim wouldn't really work. But what you could do for people that were trying to stay far apart from each other is you could have 10 people together in one room in the shul, have them very far apart from each other, but they're all together in one room. So you have a minyan, and then you can just have people zooming in and listening into that minyan. So, for example, if you need 10 people together in order to hear Megillah, which wouldn't really be the case, but where you want to hear Kriyas HaTorah, something like that, they can do what they need to do in the shul. And everybody else can hear and can fulfill their obligation, again, according to the position that thinks speaking over a microphone is halachically talking, then you fulfill your obligation by listening to Megillah over Zoom. Now, and the same thing with shofar also potentially. You can also hear shofar that way. but that's how you would have to set it up. Now, this also has the a possible exception, which I think everybody would agree, no matter what you think about whether or not it's considered halachically talking, since again, COVID started right before Pesach. We had everyone was very excited about all the halachic questions. So we ended up with a lot of Pesach questions. But for people, firstborns, Erev Pesach traditionally fast. So the way they get out of fasting is by hearing a siyum. So we did this for the students by us. But the question was, can you do a siyum over Zoom? Have one person do a siyum in one place, and everybody else can hear it. So I think irrespective of how you think of halachically, what is considered halachically talking, I think you would agree that over Zoom, you can fulfill obligations, a weird way of saying it, but you can't participate in the siyum to the point where you need in order to be able to eat. Because a siyum is not, as we say, like a davar shebikdusha. It's not something that gives you the, it's not something that you have to hear from 10 people. A siyum is something, it's not something you have to hear. It's something you have to participate in on some level. It's not even clear that you have to actually hear the siyum itself on Erev Pesach, right? If the guy's taking too long, you don't want to wait for him to finish, just go outside and grab from the food. The point is, you just have to participate in the siyum in some degree. That happiness of participating in the siyum is what will give you the. It would be enough to be considered participating in a siyum to have so that you don't have to fast. To be careful, you obviously wouldn't say Kaddish at the end, though, right? Because Kaddish at the end of the Siyam, that still requires 10 people. If you're just over Zoom, you obviously don't have the 10 people. That's okay, fine. There's no requirement to, you have to have Kaddish in order to be able to eat. You have to participate in something that's happy. So a Siyam would be good enough. Now, the other the area, again, where this becomes, the other area where potentially both positions would agree is okay, is if you think about it, if you're in a big shul. So in really big shuls, right, where you can't necessarily, everybody can't necessarily hear the chazan, so they'll set up a microphone for the, you could potentially set up a microphone for the chazan, then everyone will be able to participate, everyone will be able to hear what the chazan's saying. Now, the reason why this would work for potentially all positions is because you have all of our requirements. You'll have 10 people standing next to the chazan who hear the chazan davening, right? So that would be our 10 people. That would be our minyan. Our room has more than enough people in it. And everybody else who's just hearing from the speaker, we have a Gemara that tells us in Alexandria, there was apparently a really big shul. Not everybody was able to hear the chazan. So in order to know when to answer amen, somebody would like pick up a flag or something like that. They would signal so everybody would know what they're up to. So I don't know, I don't think there's any difference between seeing a flag go up or between hearing it from a speaker. What's the difference? The point is, you have to know when the guy finished the bracha. You know when he finished the bracha, it's irrelevant if you heard it from the speaker or if you noticed it because someone picked up a flag. Regardless, you're able to, you know what's happening, and then you'll be able to participate in the minyan. Just to point out, obviously, you can't fulfill your obligation of Megillah or of Shofar according to the position that thinks that a microphone is not considered halachically talking, right? Because you still haven't, you have to actually hear the shofar, you have to hear the Megillah directly from the chazan, and you can't hear it over the speaker. So that would only work, doing it from Megillah would only work going to the opposing view, but at least for participating in the minyan, that would be good enough. This is very important for in two areas. One is by wedding, this comes up a lot because everyone always uses a microphone when they're under the chuppah. Now, in general, this idea you should actually hear the bracha. You should have 10 people here, you should have 10 people that are participating. That are so that they're answering amen. You're doing shel brachas for the chasan and kala. So if you don't have 10 people who actually hear, because everyone's speaking directly into the microphone, you're only fulfilling your obligation according to half, according to one view. According to the other view, you're not really according to a Orbach's position. That's not good enough. You have to do without a microphone. That is where it classically comes up. The other place where it comes up is by the it came up by the Siyam HaShas. So apparently. Rabbi Reichman, who's a rabbi from LA, who has some very interesting svarim, where he discusses a lot of contemporary issues. He has he's very creative, but he relates in his he has a whole section on hearing aids and microphones, and he relates in that section that it must have been it doesn't say the year, but it must have been 3 Siyam HaShas ago because it was. Before they moved to MetLife, when they were in Madison Square Garden, he apparently was told to daven for the Amud. So he was going to be Chazen, and he was concerned that since he's going to be Chazen, he's going to be using a speaker, and then he's only, according to Shlomo Zalman, he shouldn't be a Chazen like that, because people can't actually hear him daven. So apparently he was told, at least this is what he quotes, that apparently Rabbi Yashiv said that it's okay, because he had our Alexandria solution. He had 10 people apparently next to him who were able to hear him talking. And the microphone was just for everybody else. So the people that heard him, that was his minion. And then the microphone was so that everybody else can participate as well. The problem is the last Siyam HaShas, at least I saw, I was actually learning this at the time. So I looked at the video for this section because I wanted to see what they did. And apparently they had the Chazan in his own separate area. There's no way anybody heard the Chazan himself speak. He was talking directly to a speaker and there was nobody next to him. So apparently by the last Siyam HaShas, they moved on from Eliyashiv, they found somebody else, and they felt like the opposite view, that it's not considered a problem, that speaking over a speaker, and that is considered halachically talking. I do just want to point out, but I don't want to actually discuss, I'll just mention it, there is another problem potentially with using a microphone in shul. And that is that we have this issur that we don't use musical instruments in shul because of that's what Catholics do. There's a couple of things we do because we don't want to emulate the church. So since the church uses the organ, so we don't want to have any musical instruments in our shuls. This is also, again, one of the, I think this is one of the first disagreements between the Reform movement and Orthodox Jews. Yeah, I think they one of the first things they did was they put I think they put an organ or a piano. They put something in the shul. But whatever, regardless, we Orthodox Judaism at least doesn't put in musical instruments. So this goes back to our previous discussion of Shema Yitakim. How do we think about a microphone? Do we think about a microphone as a musical instrument? Obviously, it's hard to think about it as a musical instrument if you consider halachically talking. The only way you could potentially even start making the argument that a microphone is considered a musical instrument is if it's not the human voice, is if it's considered considered the speaker talking. And then maybe that somehow is qualified as a musical instrument. I think it's a little bit of a stretch, but you could potentially start making having that debate of whether or not that would actually that would be an issue because of that problem, because of having a musical instrument in shul. So this actually really brings us to the end of the halachic talking section. I want to just conclude. So so first of all, I just want to, again, reiterate what we said in the beginning of last year. And that is that we have two separate discussions. I don't want to confuse the two. There's one issue of halachically talking, and there's one issue of halachically hearing. Halachically hearing, I think, is the problem with cochlear implants and with some of the more advanced hearing aids. That's what I would like to discuss next week. For now, we're really just discussing halachically talking. Producing sound. Producing sound, that's a question for speaker, for using a microphone through a speaker, and that's really what we were analyzing this week and last week. So again, there are two, globally, there are two views. One is that considers speaking over a microphone to be halachically talking, and the opposing view that doesn't, that thinks that is considered the speaker's talking, not that the person's talking. You can't fulfill any of your obligations that way. I'd like to point out again, I just want to emphasize that there are a lot of people that seem to think that the second view is correct, not because, again, they're not arguing from halachic, they just think mitzias, as a matter of fact, they think that the first view just didn't understand how microphones work. I find it a little bit hard to believe. I mean, some of the sources, most of the early sources think like the first view, in which case I am willing to accept that they didn't know how it works. That could very well be. But you have someone like Rav Waldenberg, Tzitz Eliezer, who thinks like the first view. It's very hard for me to imagine that he did not know how a microphone works. He's relatively recent. He only died a few years ago, whatever it is, 20 years ago or something like that. It's hard for me to believe that he didn't know how a microphone, he worked in a hospital. He was very well aware of contemporary issues. It's very hard for me to believe that he didn't know how they work. That's why, again, I really think these are two valid halachic approaches, which are just, you have to decide how you want to think about it. But those are the two ways to think about these issues. And again, the ramifications of those issues, as we said, there's the I would call it the most recent issue that I don't really have any sources for. And that's these devices for paralyzed patients, the speaker generating devices. Can we consider that halachically talking or not? Again, we potentially have, according to the first view that thinks a speaker can be considered halachically talking, they might think that that is, Rabbi Ornstein specifically, they might think that is halachically talking. And even within Rav Orbach, we could potentially make that argument. Because for Orbach's whole problem is that you have a sound wave being transmitted to an electrical signal, which is then being produced back into a sound wave. As long as you avoid that issue and outlet, what you're originally producing is the same sound wave, maybe it's irrelevant if it got produced by vocal cords or if it got produced by a speaker. I think it's unlikely, but it is possible that Rav Orbach would make that argument, or at least someone who thinks like him would make that argument. There's also, again, the issue of Kol Isha, which is, again, we can potentially differentiate between live versus recorded music, according to the position that thinks it is halachically talking. If it's not halachically talking, then it shouldn't be a problem at all, unless, of course, you want to argue that it's within the spirit of the law. There's an issue, in which case, all bets are off. If it's spirit of the law, you'll end up, you know, saying that all of it is a problem. On Shabbos, using a speaker, again, would have two potential issues, which we thought were in general not relevant, especially in situations where, for example, with a hearing aid, which is clearly a great need, which is potentially even a chola, you could potentially avoid the issues altogether. And that is either Shema Yitakin, the prohibition of fixing a musical instrument, or Avshem Milsa, the prohibition of hearing device that's doing one of the 39 melachos on Shabbos. Again, for davening, for hearing, for using a microphone in shul, So then there's obviously going to be a difference if you have 10 people that can actually hear the chazan speak and you're also using a microphone so everybody else could speak, versus if you just have 10 people without a microphone. And just, you know, the potentially only once a year issue, which is the CM for Bihar, which we think according to all views is completely irrelevant, because with, again, the issue here is not a Dabash Mikdusha, it's not a problem that you need 10 people. All you need is to somehow participate in the CM, and that should be irrelevant, you know, whether or not it's live or whether you're hearing it over a recording. And then just to obviously not forget how we started this whole conversation, how most of the sources were analyzing the difference between shofar and Megillah. That Megillah, you know, if you think it's halachically talking, then you can obviously use a microphone, a telephone, or a hearing aid without a problem. If you think it's an issue, then you obviously can't. And for shofar, so obviously, again, if you don't think it's halachically talking, then it's a problem. If you do think it's halachically talking, it will depend what you think the issue of of kol avara is, right? If you think that there is some sort of problem with using a speaker, either because maybe the sound doesn't sound as good, doesn't sound like the original, or because of, you know, some other thing interfering with the sound that is produced by the shofar, then there would potentially be a problem. But according to Moshe and the Chazon Ish, who don't think that's an issue, a shofar should still be able to be used over a speaker, assuming, again, you got rid of all the other problems of using a microphone on Shabbos and Yontif. And next week, we'll hopefully move on to cochlear implants and discuss that. Any questions? Can I clarify anything? Please.
That was wonderful. Thank you. Do acoustical issues ever come into these arguments? Because, I mean, if you think about, if you've gone to baseball games at different stadiums, how does the national anthem sound, you know, one stadium versus another? You hear a lot of echo. And there are some shuls that are big enough where you get a lot of resonance and you are hearing the chazan, but you are also hearing that echo. That chazan does not sound the same on the bima as he does if he invites you to his home in the before time for a meal. He sounds very different. The room makes that sound different. Does that come into any of this?
So I haven't really seen people discuss it. I was thinking about it because, again, some of these sources are discussing sound waves and they're trying to make it sound like they're thinking about sound waves in a purely physical sense, right? Once you do that, you end up with your issue, because you and I both know that sound waves are always bouncing off everything, right? Anytime I have furniture in the room, right? If you take a room, take out all the furniture versus having a room with it sounds totally different, right? So I think we're sort of playing ignorant to that fact, and we're not really concerned about that issue. We're concerned when it's very, very clear that there's an issue. Like when I'm blowing a shofar directly into a pit and you can clearly hear that there's an echo, that's very different than, you know, you hear my voice differently because of, I don't know, the way the roof is, the way the ceiling is shaped over my head from one position in the room versus the other. So we're not thinking about it in the purely scientific way. We have some sort of halachic sound waves, for lack of a better term, for purposes of this conversation.
There was something discussed, I remember, when pickling conservative circles, when people discussing using Zoom, and there was a case brought out of the 10th man, presumably, being outside through a window. Are you familiar with that case? And counting, at least according to someone, counting someone. There were 9 people inside, and then outside the synagogue, presumably, there was a 10th person participating, but not in the room.
So this also was a big problem, I could tell you, at least from within, you know, Orthodox circles as well. This is a very big issue. Also, for that reason, what happened was people wouldn't want to be in the same room together. So you'd have some people in one room, some people in the other room. There was a lot of people wanted to compare it to this Mishnayos by benching, where they say if the people could see each other, then they can count together for a minyan. Now, if you walked around YU and told anybody that, they would tell you you're completely confused and you're comparing two things that have nothing to do with one another. There is sources for it. There is a Mishnah Berurah that seemed to argue that people from separate places can join together as long as they're, you know, close together. As long So what ended up happening, so it's not really a speaker conversation, right? This is how you call 10 people. What is a room? So what ended up, so basically what ended up happening is if anytime you have a path, a road, then you, that breaks apart the minyan, so to speak, right? So if let's say you're davening outside, right? And everyone's on one sidewalk, but you have a street and then people are on the other side. If cars are constantly going through that street, that's a road that breaks apart the minyan. That they can't combine together. Possibly according to the Mishnah Berurah, they could, and a lot of people were relying on that. A lot of other people didn't like it. This happened, this is actually great, because what happened was in Lakewood, people wanted to continue davening with the minyan. So all these Lakewood a lot of people in Lakewood ended up doing porch minyanim. That was the big thing. Everyone on their own porch would join together. And I happen to think the Lakewood Besdin also said it doesn't work, but I know definitely in YU, the people that wanted to do it, they told them it doesn't work. That it's not 10 people in a room together. It's 10 individuals, each one in his own minyan. And as you know, as put it slightly sarcastically, each one's making a bracha levatala for themselves because there's no minyan going on. So what are you trying to accomplish? So this was a debate. There's basically, in short, there's a Mishnah Berurah that seems to say it would be okay. Mishnah Berurah seems to be arguing against most Rishonim. And so it was, I don't think, at least definitely in YU, most people did not accept it for halacha. And then you would have to have actually 10 people within a room, or if you're outside on one side of the street, in order to be considered a minyan. I know, can tell you by us, it was a problem because we davened outside a shul, which had steps leading up to a porch in front of the shul, right? So some people, the chazan wanted to go up on the steps and everybody else was on the sidewalk. Right, which I thought was, which again, if you don't think the Mishnah Berurah, it's a problem. The chazan has nothing to do with the minyan. There's 9 people, or whatever. There's the minyan downstairs, and then there's some guy randomly yelling from the top of a porch. That's absolutely nothing to do with them. This again was totally depends on what you think. Like this also became probably because some people who didn't think that they would work were going to other places who thought it did work, and then they asked them to be a chazan, and then you end up with the political issues of how to be friendly, well, it's a big question, but I don't think, in general, you'd have to be in one room or you'd have to be on one side of the street in order to count as a room for halachic purposes for a minyan.
Yeah, I just want to add, I don't want to take, because Rabbi Cohen's a speaker. This question came up when we had outside minyanim. We were davening outside in the back of the shul. And there was, there's a halacha that a makam she'en kavul a minyan, that a place that's not established as a minyan, it's questionable whether you need a mechitza, right? So when we daven outside, women were in the back of the parking lot, and we were in the front. I live in the back, the shul and my parking lot, the shul in my backyard abut to each other. There's a fence. And there were two women, not my wife, there were two women who stayed in our backyard. And I questioned whether they fulfilled the mitzvah of tefillah b'tzibur because it was at a different rishus, a different area. And then I heard from Rav Shechta from YU, who said that if someone was on a porch, he could not be masarif in the minyan because that's totally a different rishus. So that would fit into what you're saying, YU would not have people in different balconies or in different areas join in one minyan.
Right. We also had a similar problem also with the women that were coming to daven. They couldn't hear because it was across the street.
They wanted
to come to our side. And then people were, some people, at least, again, I told you before, we had a very wide range of
a
bunch of medical school students. So you have people from everywhere. So some people got offended. It's not a makot field. There's no halacha.
Not an issue.
They could be next to each other. I mean, you should be a little bit apart, but they could be next to each other. There's also the problem I didn't see a single place in Israel that did it. The only place in Israel that potentially would have listened to me didn't listen to me, so it was irrelevant. But you shouldn't also, after Vayechulu, Bracha Achas Bein Sheva, right? You wouldn't have to say it, right? Everyone knows that when you go to a Sheva Brachas, right, when people are making their own minyan, so Friday night, they all get really excited because there's that one guy that always gets to shout out. After you finish Shalom Aleichem, he shouts out, say Kaddish. You don't say the rest of Chazaras HaShatz that you normally would, right? But that reason is, it's nothing to do with a wedding. It has to do with the only time we say it is when you're in a shul, when you're in a place that's makam kavua for tefillah. When you're outside, this is obviously temporary. Even when you're, this is not a place that's meant to be a kavua shul. There is no, you're not supposed to be saying it. There's no reason to say it at all. I did not see a single place that didn't say it. Everywhere that I saw at least said it. And when I point, at least in our show, I came a few weeks after COVID started. I was in America when we first started. So they'd already started saying it. And when I pointed it out to someone that I don't think we should be saying it, they got offended and I just dropped it. I didn't want to say anything else. But again, people like it a lot. It's, you know, it's part of Friday night. That's what makes Shabbos. They have to say it. So what are you going to
do? In Syracuse, we did not say it.
There we go. I assume in America, I would have found a little more places that I probably was in Israel where all thought. Again, a lot of them thought that their place was considered a Makom Kavua. And I don't think they're right. I don't think it's considered a Makom Kavua because, again, it's also a problem with the woman. Right, with davening next to each other, Ramosha says it's unclear where Ramosha comes up with it though. But Ramosha says that if you daven more than three times in the same place, then you have to have a mechitza. But it's unclear, where Ramosha came up with that from. Right, in general, assumingly, what he means is with three times, meaning that now that place is considered a shul because it make it a makom kavua for tefillah. Right, but no one can argue that you know when you're outside. And that the only reason why you're outside is clearly because you're scared to be inside. And as soon as you can, you're going to run inside because that's where the air conditioning or heating is, right? Like it's obviously, it's not a Makom Kavua. I have a hard time, even Ramosha, people that were quoting this Ramosha's tshuva for saying women can't daven next to the men without a mechitza outdoors. I doubt that Ramosha would make that same argument there. It's clearly not a Makom Kavua for tefillah. There's no halacha that you have to have a mechitza.
I'm just curious, the ones who did say Magen Avos and everything, did they do Nefilas Sapayim outside? Were they think about that. If they held that one, I mean, just curious, because of an extension of the shul, then they'd be able to do Nefilas Sapayim.
Most of these shuls that I was aware of at least skipped Tachna.
They skipped Tachna.
This is a whole different situation.
It's COVID, we'll skip Tachna. No.
So it wasn't really relevant.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we did Tachna standing up. Basically, it's, you know, non tefillah sapayim. So, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry. I just it was after this year. So,
no, please, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Anything else I can answer or clarify?
Okay.
Yeah, great. So next week, hopefully we'll move on to cochlear implants and to some of the more advanced hearing aids. Some of the way they work will be very interesting halachic ramifications for what is considered halachic hearing. That's what I want to tackle next. Right. Thank you for joining and for listening.
Very good. Everybody.